This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 8th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at a few things that went on here in the area of taxes. I'm going to start out first by looking at the new tax bill we got this week, the Taxpayer First Act of 2019. We'll talk about a few highlights of that bill. Again, it's a bill, so we're going to have highlights, shall we say. And we'll also then move on to look at some of our developments during the week. We'll talk about the fact that the Supreme Court gave us a decision on how they're going to deal with the trust case came out of Minnesota. You may have remembered last year we talked about both the Kastner case that came out of North Carolina and at the same time about a case Fielding that came out of Minnesota. The Supreme Court has acted on the Kastner case. They had put aside the Fielding case temporarily, and now we're going to see how they took care of it at the end. We have proposed regulations to try to deal with what's referred to as the one bad apple rule for a multiple employer plan. We'll talk about how that one works up. The IRS went back to the frequently asked questions yet again on their website to provide some information, this time regarding qualified opportunity zone investments, qualified opportunity fund investments, I should say, and some changes that occurred in the second set of proposed regs with regard to Section 1231 gains. I suppose they weren't really changes, they just were guidance we didn't have, and some relief they're granting because of some unexpected part of that guidance, at least to some taxpayers. We have two sets of final regulations we're going to talk about this week. We have final regulations that are going to permit employers to truncate Social Security numbers on W-2s, but we're going to discover that's not going to happen until the 2020 W-2s, at least at this point. And then also final regulations the IRS dealing with that issue that the IRS has become a lot more talked about recently, about partners acting as employees of a partnership. Suffice it to say, the IRS doesn't really like that idea. And we're going to find out what they did this week on that idea, which is something that they told us about a couple of years ago, basically 3 years ago, and now it becomes final regulations. Now, with that, coming up, I'm going to be heading off to Albuquerque this week, actually, to take a course from Howard Siebelman, who also lectures for Kaplan Financial Education. In that case, he lectures on the accounting and auditing topics, and I'll be taking a class from him on Wednesday on disclosures. But I'm also going over there because I'll be coming back later in the month to deal with a couple of courses there in Albuquerque as well. For those of you in New Mexico, on July 22nd, I will be at the New Mexico Society of CPAs offices for construction contractors, specialized tax and accounting issues. On July the 23rd, I'll be doing advanced partnership issues, including the new partnership audit rules. We'll take a look at both of those issues that day. Those are issues that are going to be of interest, shall we say. You know, the construction contractor one is always kind of an interesting case. And this year, speaking of A&A, this is a year for the new revenue recognition standard. We'll talk about how that standard impacts construction contractors. We'll also talk about the tax rules for construction contracts, for those of you who just can't get enough of having to do all those wonderful look-back calculations. We'll talk about the look-back calculation, how it works, and those whole things. And then advanced partnership issues on July 23rd. We'll talk about the new partnership audit rules we're doing this year. That's kind of our starting point. And then we'll also talk about some of the other issues that impact partnerships from an advanced standpoint, including, by the way, that whole question about employment of partners. We'll talk some about that because obviously the IRS is interested in that particular topic right now. We'll talk a little bit about why partners do it, why the IRS doesn't like it, and what we can do with our partnerships where maybe somebody's insisting on being an employee. We'll try to deal with that particular situation. But with that, let's go to the brand new law we got issued that was signed into law on July the 1st by President Trump. And the law is the Taxpayer First Act of 2019. That act, signed in, as I said, July 1st, became law. It had stalled in the U.S. Senate based on free e-file. But those provisions were removed from the law. For those of you who are going to be downloading, and I would suggest you might take a look at it in this case if you don't normally download the articles, we will have uploaded on the website a full outline of the Taxpayer First Act. Well, it's not completely full. There are some parts there that were just wildly internal to the IRS that just didn't seem worth writing about. But we have most of the major portions written up in that article. We'll talk about what they are, their effective dates, which is really important to note, and what they do. You can download that particular document along with this week's articles at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We have it there on the main page. I put the link to this on the main page, and right at this instant, it's the top story. It won't stay there when the next story goes up. But, you know, if you get in here real quick, you might grab it as a top story. It'll be there right away. There's a button you click. You get the button. You'll get that, the PDF, into your browser. You can then do a save in the browser and kick that PDF off to your hard drive and do whatever you'd like to do with it. You know, print it out, read it, mark it up, all those neat things related to this brand new act. We do have a new tax law. May not be our last one this year, but it's the one we've got for the moment, so you might take a look at it. Some of the changes that are in here, and we've got more I'm going to cover, but let's talk about some of the changes that I want to cover this morning or this afternoon. It depends on when you're listening. Maybe let's do it this evening. I have no idea. 2 a.m. listening could be kind of interesting to this sort of stuff. We have, though, a special change in how innocent spouse cases are going to be reviewed by the tax court. The tax court will now always review them in what's called a de novo form. What that means is the tax court will actually take a look at the administrative records, as well as any information that came to light after the administrative records that the taxpayer was not aware of or that didn't become available until after that date because the taxpayer didn't have access to it or it didn't exist. That could create some fights between the IRS and taxpayers about what's actually allowed to be used in this case. You know, we'll have to watch and see how that goes in. But it definitely means we'll get that. They also will now allow taxpayers in innocent spouse cases to ask for refunds in cases where they previously could not do that. If they had paid off the liability because they saw that big bill it was due, now, as long as the statute is not expired for filing a claim for refund, they could go back, they qualify for innocent spouse relief, and ask for that money back. That's also going to be part of this rule. So those are interesting things for innocent spouse claims. We also have special rules that were changed for IRS's notices to third parties of contacts. You may remember we talked about the JBPB versus United States case from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals earlier this year, where the IRS tried to claim that providing a taxpayer with Publication 1, your rights as a taxpayer, at the beginning of an exam, where there was like a sentence that said, you know, if we can't get information from you, we may contact third parties, that was sufficient notice as required under the law. And that was true even though they didn't go back and actually get this information until 2 years later. Well, Congress decided, the Ninth Circuit said that doesn't work and, you know, said that was beyond reasonable. The Congress decided that we should have a definition of what's reasonable in this case. And they're telling the IRS that you cannot contact third parties unless, right, you've got to, you know, you've got to tell the taxpayer that you're going to do it separately, not just in Publication 1. You've got to only do it, and the notice only given when you actually believe you have to make that contact. So you're going to tell them you're going to go there. You cannot go more than a year out after the date you tell them that. You're going to have to kind of contact again if you want to tell them we're going to go to third parties more than a year out. Yeah, and you got to, like I said, realistically want to do it. So you can't just do a blanket case. They will take effect for notices provided and contacts of persons made after August 15th of this year. So for the next month and a half, you've still got the old rule in place, but this one will change on August the 15th. So be ready for that change in a representation capacity. IRS was also directed to try to deal with something about misdirected refunds. You know, we have that little problem where refunds end up going to the wrong taxpayer. So by 6 months from the date of enactment, by January 1st of 2020, they're going to have regulations published to allow taxpayers to report instances where refunds made by the IRS to electronic transfers did not hit my account. And they're going to coordinate with financial institutions to identify those amounts and get them returned. Right? Those will be the key issues the IRS has to deal with this year. So hopefully by next filing season, this will be January 1st, 2020, we'll have such a program in place to deal with those misdirected refunds. The IRS has also been directed to expand the program for IP PINs. IP PINs, you may, if you've had clients who've had identity theft issues, the IRS may have issued this thing called an Identity Protection Personal Identification Number, or IP PIN, to the taxpayer. Well, the IRS is to establish a program that no later than January 1st, 2024, is to be available nationwide that will allow taxpayers to effectively request an IP PIN, not just have to wait for the service to deem they should have one. Right now, in certain states, you can do that. The IRS is directed until July 1st, 2024. Each calendar year, they are to expand the number of states, and based on states, they believe where this is most important to get the expansion done, but they are to expand it every year. And by July 1st, 2024, make it available nationwide. You'll have to keep up and see if this is available in the state you work in or the state your clients live in. And if clients are interested in it, you may have to take a look at what the procedure will be to get one. But the IRS has been directed to expand this program nationwide. We'll see how well it works, because there really is a downside to expanding it too. I don't know if Congress really fully considered the downside. There are a couple of downsides. One, which we hit all the time, is the client loses the IP PIN, which then complicates filing the return. And they're like, but I'm me. It's like, yeah, but you asked for an IP PIN because more than one person is showing up and saying they're you. And that's going to complicate matters. The other problem is trying to make sure that under no circumstances somebody who is not the taxpayer somehow ends up with the IP PIN. You know, so the only person who can file a return is the fraudster. That also is a possibility if we're not careful of how this is expanded. That's the concern with expanding it rapidly. So we'll see if over the 5 years we get a program in place that doesn't cause that nightmare to happen. The IRS is also directed for victims of ID theft to have a single point of contact. That is, now, it's not really a single employee, because here's the problem. We can't very well tell the IRS employees that you're not allowed to leave. You can't quit. Sorry, guys, you can't quit. You're stuck here, you know, until every taxpayer that was assigned to you has their ID theft case resolved. So if that takes 6 years, you're stuck working with the IRS for the next 6 years. I guess it's job security, because apparently the IRS couldn't fire this person either. But, you know, probably not what that doesn't work. So what they say is they got to set up a group. So your one point of contact may end up being still multiple points of contact, but they set up a group. They're supposed to communicate. That group's accountable for handling the case until its resolution. You know, they are allowed to change employees on the case for obvious reasons. They might not be there. Also, I guess you're not allowed to die if you're an IRS employee. That's also a little tougher to enforce. You know, although I'm sure the employees would love to have a method to ensure that, you know, we just make sure that's not going to happen to me, then maybe I would work forever for the IRS. I don't know, you know, if you could ensure that. But otherwise, you know, reminds me now of those nightmarish science fiction programs where they tell you, you know, somebody living forever and the nightmare of doing that. So maybe it wouldn't be so great. We'd have to see. But anyway, those programs are in place. This new program, the IRS has developed them as rapidly as practicable. As I recall, is the idea for this, so we'll see how quickly that particular thing runs out. We also have in here an expansion of mandatory e-file. What we're going to be doing now is we're going to have, for tax returns, we're going to be expanding over the next few years, and by 2021 is what's going to happen. By 2021, if you file 20 or more returns of any type, W-2s, K-1s, etc., you're going to have to electronically file every return you file. This is meant to get after people who are still paper filing W-2s, 1099s, etc. We're going to be down to 20 by then. Partnerships will eventually go down to 10. They'll be lower, so they'll be down to 10. If they have 10 K-1s, they'll have to, or 10 returns in general. So basically, this is how it works, okay? So that'll be our revised limit. So in 2022, we're going to essentially have to file 10. We're going to kind of be there. So we'll see how it goes. That'll be our background there. Couple of other big changes that were involved in this. We do have to have not-for-profits are now going to have to electronically file all of their returns. Right now, we have a weird situation where if you're really small not-for-profit, you have to file the e-postcard. If you're a large not-for-profit, you have to file electronically already. But if you're in the middle, the Goldilocks just right group, you could still paper file all your returns. Well, Congress decided that just seems absurd, that the very smallest have to electronically file, but the ones net one size up, if you grow just slightly, we don't need to electronically file. So they're going to say, no, all not-for-profits will file electronically. The IRS is also directed to come up with a way to make the e-file information they receive be machine-readable. So that's their takeaway. Also, one nice thing is going to happen here. You may have had this problem. The IRS is going to have to notify not-for-profits if they've not received a return in 2 years from them. That includes e-postcards. The problem we ran into, we went to the e-postcard system. Small not-for-profits. Remember, Congress said you do the e-postcard, but you don't file for 3 years. We terminate your status. This law says if we've gone 2 years with no return, if the IRS has gone 2 years, has not received a return from the not-for-profit, it is to notify the not-for-profit that it's not received a return for 2 years, and also to specifically tell them if we don't receive one next year, you will lose your tax-exempt status. So, you know, hopefully wake them up so that they will go out and get this done. If they weren't aware they had to, they'll take care of it. That's obviously something that would be helpful, shall we say, on this standpoint. Finally, we also have an increase to pay for this in a penalty that's that odd penalty. Remember, if you file your tax returns more than 60 days late, if your tax return is more than 60 days late, then the penalty is the basically greater of the standard failure to file penalty, 5% of the tax due per month after adjusting for the failure to pay penalty, or in this case, the lesser of, I love when they do the greater of than the lesser of, but the secondary penalty is the lesser of, used to be $205 adjusted for inflation, it will become $330, and then we'll begin adjusting for inflation in 2020, or 100% of the amount of tax shown required to be shown on the return. So if the tax required to be shown on the return was $200, your minimum penalty would be $200. If the tax required to be shown on the return was zero, then you still got no penalty, right? If the tax required to be shown on the return was $1,000, your penalty would be $330, because that's going to be still less than, this is the third month, it's going to be less than 3 months of failure to file penalties, or greater than 3 months of failure to file penalties, and it's less than the tax on the return, so that would be your penalty for being more than 60 days late. Again, doesn't affect a lot of taxpayers, but those it does, this is how they're getting the money to pay for, because there is some revenue cost to enacting this bill. This is how they paid for it. They came down, they did this way. That's their pay for. Let's go on to the cases this week, or actually the other things that happened. I want to start out with the Supreme Court doing something this week. You may remember we talked about this back last summer when the Kastner Trust case came down. We also talked about the fact that we had a second case that was Minnesota Department of Revenue versus Fielding. That came out on June the 28th. That June the 28th Fielding case was another case where a state Supreme Court said, you know what, state revenue department, you have no right to tax this trust. But the reason that Minnesota State Supreme Court decided that they had no right to tax the trust, it was still constitutional, it was still the due process clause, but in their case, they said because the settlor was a Minnesota resident, when the trust became irrevocable, or when the settlor died and the trust was created by his estate, that trust had to file a Minnesota return, even though by the time the year in question came forward here, there was no property in Minnesota, there was no Minnesota trustee, there was no beneficiary in Minnesota. There was nothing in Minnesota except the original settlor had lived in Minnesota on the date the trust became irrevocable. Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that that was not appropriate, that was insufficient contact with the state of Minnesota to allow the state to tax the trust. Now, Minnesota Department of Revenue, just like the North Carolina Department of Revenue, filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court asking the court to hear the case, you know, and of course overturn the Minnesota Supreme Court, but pointed out that there were state Supreme Courts that come on down on different sides on this issue, because this is not an unusual way for states to claim they have a right to tax a trust. It's not, you know, there are other ways, and states use every way imaginable for the most part to come up with this. But it's, you know, if I had to come up with the one method I see most often, if you review the state rules for when you have to file, this one tends to show up more than any of the others, at least more consistently. So they're saying, look, we need to settle this. Does this violate due process? In which case, not only can't Minnesota do it, but neither can any other state. Or is it fine on the due process clause? So the Minnesota Supreme Court was in error. So unless there's some other reason why the state of Minnesota can't collect this tax, the Minnesota case should be reversed. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court issued the Casener decision. They had put this on hold. You know, they didn't decide what to do with it. They did not combine it with Casener, as the state of Minnesota requested. They just kind of put it on hold. Well, we're coming up to the end of the term. This thing still hadn't been decided. Probably didn't surprise most people, except maybe to disappoint Minnesota, that Supreme Court decided they would not hear this case. So they've decided to let stand the Minnesota court ruling. What that means in this case, let's talk about the difference. They decided Casener. That tells us that, in fact, we now know that if a state tries to tax a trust based solely on having a beneficiary who is a current beneficiary but has no right to income, no way to force the income, they would get income if the trustee decided an income distribution was appropriate, but there's a chance they'll never see any. If that's true, then yeah, you can't tax it. No state can use that. But as a practical matter, aside from North Carolina, only Georgia and Tennessee have that as a sole criterion for taxing a trust. The other states that, you know, there are other states that use that criteria, California being the best known, but California uses other criteria as well. So we're not sure how this case would impact anybody except Georgia and Tennessee, along with North Carolina, and Tennessee's getting rid of their income tax, so it's like that'll go away shortly. So really we're down to Georgia and North Carolina. Georgia's the only state that was affected aside from North Carolina. In the case of Minnesota case, even though your state may use that method, or the state that the trust is having to file in these days may use the same method as Minnesota, unless that state Supreme Court has ruled that to be unconstitutional, you're probably still going to find that the revenue department is going to collect the tax. It's up to you to litigate and see what that state Supreme Court would say. And there are some states that have said this is perfectly okay. So we haven't had any decision there. The only thing we know for sure out of this is the Minnesota decision stands. So if you have a trust in Minnesota and the only reason you're filing a Minnesota trust return is because the trustee, I should say not the trustee, but the settlor was a Minnesota resident, yeah, you probably can stop filing that return now, right? Minnesota does not have the right to do that. The Supreme Court of Minnesota will control in this case. So we're good for now. We'll see if more comes up later from other directions. Now, we have a proposed regulation, Reg 121-508-18, issued on July 3rd. This deals with multiple employer plan rules and the overall unified plan rule that's in play, right? The catch in this case, multiple employer plans are a plan where there are multiple employers that aren't related, but banded together, or at least were found, and form a plan. You know, like a defined contribution plan in this case is what we're talking about in this case for this group. And that defined contribution plan covers all of their employees. And the reason they do that is because we only have to pay an administrator. You know, we can split the administrator's fee among all of us by having a combined plan. The administrator will account for our employees. They'll get the information from each of the employers. They'll take care of all the plan administration. But the problem, because that plan has to qualify, is we have this thing called the Unified Plan Rule. That plan's qualification is an all or nothing issue. And that's raised concerns about what's called the one bad apple problem. If one of the employers decides to do something bad, like stop reporting employee information to the plan, it just doesn't get there. If they decide to only report information on the owners because they don't want to pay for the employees, they do something that clearly violates the plan. And we discover they've been doing it. They just have left off all the rank and file every time they sent us information. The administrator or something discovers this. We got a problem. Our plan is disqualified, and we have no good way to fix it because the plan's blown its qualification in the past, and probably the bad apple's not going to agree to any free fixes. In that case, they're just going to go ahead and still be the bad apple and say, well, just don't tell. If you don't tell the IRS Department of Labor, they'll never figure it out. Yeah, famous last words. You know, what do you do? Now, this proposed regs, and it's just proposed, would provide a method to deal with this. What you would do is, if this becomes final, you cannot do this currently, please make sure you understand that, the bad actor, all of the assets related to participants from the bad actor would be spun out to a separate plan, and that plan would be immediately terminated. So we'd basically kick the bad actor out. anything the bad actor did that is a qualification issue would basically now taint the plan we just kicked out. So if the IRS decided to retroactively terminate status 2 years ago, they wouldn't retroactively terminate the MEP. They would retroactively terminate this kind of piece of the plan that was kicked out separately. So that allows the bad apple to get there. Now, there's still a problem that the administrator's got to recognize they have a bad apple. They got to get the bad apple out of the plan. But the other big problem right now is that we cannot use this until the regulation is finalized. So you can't go out and establish a profit-sharing plan among seven employers and, you know, put in these bad apple provisions. That's not going to work. We need to wait for the regulations to go final. They're just now released, so obviously it's going to take a while. As we'll talk about later, we have regulations in an area where the IRS really got no comments negative on the reg, at least, or I should say no comments they decided to follow. Actually, there were negative, but they decided not to follow any of them. But, you know, before they had this, we can expect some back and forth on this about how to handle it. You know, it took 3 years to get those out, so I wouldn't go set this up right now. However, there is a second way this might be fixed. The SECURE Act, which is also kind of like the Taxpayer First Act, got stalled in the Senate. The SECURE Act is also stalled in the Senate. If the SECURE Act passes, that has a slight modification on this method of dealing with the one bad apple rule. It would go to these, basically these pooled plans, which would be a successor to the multiple employer plan, but essentially the same thing would happen. The pooled plan would be able to kick out the bad actor, and we'd go down that path, same thing. So watch the SECURE Act if it passes. Otherwise, keep a close eye on this multiple employer plan rule. It may very well be if the SECURE Act passes, these regs simply will never go final. If the SECURE Act doesn't pass, then the IRS would use these regs. These regs were issued in response to an executive order issued last year to try to encourage this thing to reduce the cost of being part of a plan. So we'll see how that goes. Well, the IRS definitely loves frequently asked questions on their website. And they have yet again gone back and added information to their frequently asked questions on a topic from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. This time it is Opportunity Zone investments. The Opportunity Zone's Frequently Asked Questions page on the IRS website was updated on June the 28th. And it was updated to deal with an issue that arises under the proposed regulations that were issued on May 1st of last year. And it has to do with 1231 gains and the reinvestment of those gains into qualified opportunity funds. Under those regulations issued in May, the 180-day period for reinvesting does not start until after we've netted 1231 gains and losses at the end of the year, because we first have to determine if the 1231 gain or loss would be a capital gain or not. You can only reinvest capital gains, remember. If the net 1231 gains and losses turns out to be a net 1231 loss, every gain and loss in that pool is considered to be, or in that kind of, I guess called a pool, whatever you want to call a grouping, is considered to be ordinary and wouldn't qualify for QOF reinvestment. Well, the problem, of course, was we didn't know that we were going to hold these things until December in 2018. So if you incurred a large 1231 gain in February of 2018, you pretty much thought I didn't have until December 31st, 2018 to make my QOF reinvestments. You know, if I waited till December 31st to make the investments, I was outside the 180-day period, I believed. So I already reinvested before the end of the year. Well, that causes a problem because, you know, if that's what we did, we now have a non-qualified reinvestment. We're going to pay tax on a 1231 gain, the 18 return, and we're not going to get the benefits. So what the IRS has decided to do is they're saying, if in fact you have a 1231 gain in 2018, and you could reinvest either by 180 days after the date of sale of the asset or 180 days after the date on which, you know, the year ends, normally December. At this point, probably both have passed, but that's your temporary relief for 18. For 19, we're going to have to wait for the final regulations. The regs come out. You know, we have the hearing is this week on the second set of proposed regs. When we'll see the final regs, I'd hope it'd be relatively soon because, again, we're running into some issues with deadlines, especially for the special rule to get the full 15%, you know, basically forgiveness of the original gain because of step-up in basis. on the funds, on the investment that has to take place by December 31st, essentially of 2026, because the 7-year holding period, you have to have it the 7 years, and that's the date we're going to do gains. We'd like to know before the end of the year. We'll see if we find that out. We have two sets of final regulations issued this week. The first set of final regs is Treasury Decision 9861, issued on July 3rd. It tells us the IRS will allow employee W-2s to have truncated Social Security numbers. This is being done to basically help prevent identity theft. Employers are wanting to prevent identity theft. They're not keen on mailing W-2s out to employees that, they can't get them to on site where the Social Security number is in there, because somebody steals the envelope, which is going to say important tax return information enclosed, they're going to get the Social Security number of the employee. They should prefer to do that. These truncated ones will only show the last 4 digits, so you may have like that star, then the 4 digits, or X's and the 4 digits. This is per regulations under 6011 for truncated numbers just in general. You've already seen those on like broker 1099s. They're come out there. Now, the copy to Social Security has still got to have the employee's full Social Security number, and the employer identification number has still got to be shown in full on all copies on the return. If you have to provide under the general rules for truncated numbers, you're never allowed to use it where you're providing the number to a third party that needs the number. And the employee needs the EIN number because that's required for electronic filing. Conversely, the employee can't give you a truncated Social Security number in response to, when they file their W-4. They have to give you the full one. They're not allowed to truncate. Now, one thing that's a little concerning is this does not apply until 2020 W-2s. It is effective for W-2s filed after, required to be filed after December 31st, 2019. Well, 2020, I should say, not 19. That means the 2020 W-2s, the 19 W-2s will be filed after December 31st of 2019. Those aren't covered by this rule. Why? Well, the IRS's main reason is saying that the states need time to adapt their rules, so they won't require employees to, employee copies to have the full Social Security, because it kind of defeats the purpose if, the copies to the IRS don't have them, but the copies to the state of fill in the blank, whatever state you're involved with, inside that envelope has the full number. I just need on one form if I'm a bad guy stealing that envelope. Now, the problem, of course, with that is, but what if the state gets in line by the end of this year? Why am I being penalized because some other state that I don't live in, can't basically get everything together in time to get rid of the requirement to have my full social on that 1099, on that W-2. And my guess is the IRS just doesn't want to upset the states, because the problem is, in some cases, this could be by statute, and a lot of legislatures don't meet all year, so they won't be back till January. So my guess is lots of those issues, but it might be possible the IRS might later give us a notice or something that might grant relief. If you do want to use this, you can, and then you just check and see if the state allows it to happen. We also have final regulations, TD 9869, June 28th of this year. This is on final regulations where we have partners who are being treated as employees. Generally, the IRS doesn't like this. These particular regs were issued back in May of 2016 in proposed form, are adopted essentially without change, and they dealt with the use of a disregard entity to attempt to employ partners. So let's say my accounting firm goes out and forms Accountants Employees LLC, and it basically pays all of its payroll through Accountants Employees LLC, so all the employees of the partnership are paid through there, and the partners are listed as employees. And you're doing that because the argument went, well, for payroll tax purposes, we go get a separate ID number for the LLC, we treat it as a separate entity in various structures, so hey, I can be an employee of that, I just won't be an employee of the partnership, so I'm not violating the rules. And by the way, by doing that, I can qualify to have withholding taken out of my check, and I can qualify for certain benefits like a cafeteria plan that I couldn't qualify for if I was a partner. Well, the IRS says no, that's not allowed. The IRS is very, very insistent on this area. They cite Revenue Ruling 69-184 as authority for position that a partner can never be an employee of a partnership. Okay. Now, that revenue ruling doesn't really tell us why that's true. Unlike most revenue rulings, this has no recitation of the law that justifies this. It simply tells us it's the case. But we now have a regulation that very clearly comes to the same conclusion. We've also had other guidance this year. The IRS is becoming pretty clear they don't like this. If you remember, we talked about this a couple months back in April. We had a chief counsel advice email, 2019-16-004, that talked about the professional employer organization workaround, and the IRS wasn't too thrilled about that. We've also had discussions of certain other structures that were used. And again, the IRS is not thrilled with those structures. If a PEO hires the partner, that doesn't make them an employee. IRS made that clear in this advice. Basically, they're saying partners cannot be employees of partnership, and whatever structure you've got to suppose he makes this work, IRS position is it doesn't work. How you deal with that? A little more interesting for your partnerships who may have this. IRS so far has not taken any action that I know of against a partnership where no advantage was gained, but it's very tempting to gain an advantage. The partner wants to be covered by something he can't be covered by because he's not an employee, or he didn't even realize that that's the issue, and he just gets himself in. Or secondly, somebody gets to the end of the year, realize they have underpaid their taxes, and says, oh, I can just do a big payout at the end, huge withholding on my final paycheck, and cover my and go all the way back for the whole year. Either of those are major problems. The basic rule is right now you're going to try to get your partnerships to agree you just can't do this and stop doing it. Well, remember, check your state CPA societies for the CPE they're offering. We at Kaplan work through the state CPA societies for the most part in presenting our programs. You want to find us, you'll find us there. You can check there. They have other highly qualified individuals who are also teaching courses for the states. By the way, if you want our courses offered by your state, check and make sure they know what you want. Make sure you want to talk to this. You want to see us come out there and do some sessions. You want me to come out and do some updates for you. We do those things, and you have to go through your state society. We do also do firms, but whenever you do an on-site for a firm, realistically, you probably need at least 15 or so, or some sort of a course that everybody would attend, and then maybe 10 can make it work with the math. But that's really the problem, just because the cost brings someone out and doing it, because you got to factor not just the cost of paying for the instructor, but also the cost of paying for the travel, the hotel, the other things will have to be done with the instructor. But that's a possibility too. You can talk about either of these with your state society. You can talk about that as well. But again, check there, get registered. This is a year where a lot of changes are happening, both in accounting auditing and in tax. You want to make sure that you're up to date. Again, in tax, we've got all the regulations we expect to be finalized this year on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, a whole bunch of other guidance, and maybe, we'll get a technical corrections bill. We'll need to watch for that. Those are all things where it's really nice to have a live instructor who can tell you what maybe happened the night before. The problem here is, yes, there are cheaper ways to get your CPE. A lot of those cheaper ways are cheaper because they're involved on courses that simply aren't updated regularly. Things don't happen quickly. And this is not a year you can afford to live with a manual on something like partnership taxation that was written 4 years ago and is missing things about the partnership audit regime, is missing things about these partners as employees, is missing the self-employment tax issues. Yeah, these are all things that are changing, that may change again, and those are things you get with live CPE that you simply don't get on the really cheap stuff or the stuff that comes free with lunches. This has been Current Federal Tax Development. You can catch our regular updates on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We also have questions and comments. Send it to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can go ahead and follow me on Twitter. You can find me there at edzollers. I also follow discussions on various discussion boards on tax issues. For state societies, I'm a member of the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey state societies, and I follow their discussions on their Connect sites. If you're a member there, you can post their Connect group, and if I see it and I feel I have some expertise, maybe I can add, I'll try to comment on it. You can also follow me. I try to keep an eye every so often on the Tax Talk group on the California Society's Tax Talk group. That one, any CPA anywhere across the country can log into. If you just go to Yahoo Groups and you go look for Tax Talk is one word, you should be able to ask to join. You do have to be approved to get in. But if you're a CPA in any state, you should be approved. And, you know, we can cover stuff there. On Reddit, I follow the subreddit at /r/taxpros. We follow any postings there. So you want to post there, that's also good. Otherwise, we'll be back here next week with whatever goes on in taxes. We'll see you there. You know, make sure you watch. Make sure you be waiting for next week. We know stuff's going to happen. We just don't know what. So we'll be back here in a week from now and talk to you about whatever happens in the area of federal taxes.